if you're going to do a big transaction, involve a legal person who's specialized in that, and not because you love spending the money, but because their job is to protect you from making a terrible mistake.
Yeah, I just have a seller client right now where they've been talking the other day, and he's like, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes in business. He's like, but the biggest mistake I ever made was signing a bad contract years ago.
This is Super Fast Business with James Schranko. James Schranko. Helping you build your business super fast.
James Schranko here. Welcome back to superfastbusiness.com. Today we're covering the topic of buying a business. We've got plenty of episodes on Super Fast Business about selling. And for everyone who sells a business, someone has to be buying that business. So I've brought on a specialist in this field, Eric Owens from appbusinessbrokers.com. That's appbusinessbrokers.com. And Eric has been selling businesses and facilitating transactions for people with internet, e-com, SaaS solutions, mobile apps, and has built up a fairly good reputation. I actually originally got referred to Eric from Ezra Firestone, another great friend of our Super Fast Business community. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Yeah, thanks, James. Appreciate you having me on. Yeah, definitely. Ezra's a cool person. I'm glad he connected us up way back when. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, Ezra has, started and sold quite a few e-commerce stores. And originally, when I was looking to enter into selling my businesses, I asked Ezra, who's good at this, and he sent me your details, and we had a conversation, and you sent me over a checklist. As it turns out, I was able to just sell the business myself.
Sure.
But I think that was through probably a fortunate scenario of both the business units that I sold, I ended up selling to customers of mine. So I already knew the buyers, which took away a huge part of the equation from the point of view of a broker. And also, I was, I'm pretty comfortable with buying and selling from my previous experience, so that I wasn't worried at all about the negotiation phase or the pressure of making offers or the scrutiny. I've seen it all before in high pressure sales environments. So two of the factors that I imagine are very appealing about broking service were not present for me. However, if I didn't know the customer, or if I was uncomfortable buying or selling, I think a broker is going to become a really great asset for someone in that situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like you said, if you have, with your experience with negotiating and selling to someone you know, that definitely helps with a couple of those factors where most business owners don't have that negotiating experience or being able to value their business and know what's a good deal and what's not, or and the buyers they may work with, you know, they don't know who they are really. So.
So just a very short contextual backdrop for appbusinessbrokers.com. What sort of transactions have you been working with over the last few years to give us a feel for the scope and, you know, the relevant history that you've had in this field?
Yeah, definitely. I'm like an old timer in the internet business world, where I've been doing my own internet business stuff for almost 20 years now. And then sold my own internet businesses back in 2003 and just started lining up deals for other people and brokering deals ever since then. I've always kind of loved it in terms of helping seller clients sell their business and transform their lives. Especially some people have gone on to do really well, like Ezra. We helped him sell his costume wig site way back when, and some other guys like Matt Clark and Mike Koenigs and Andrew Fox, Chavaretta, those type of guys. So we love that part of it. I think the internet business industry has been really interesting the last couple of years, especially. It's been growing up really, really fast, I'd say, where the businesses are getting more sophisticated and substantial. And now buyers of all different varieties are looking to buy internet businesses, where before it used to be lots of individuals buying them, you know, lifestyle type business approach, where now that they're bigger businesses, we're getting private equity companies and, you know, other bigger companies that are looking to buy internet businesses, which is way different than it was just a couple of years ago. So the deals we've been working on lately have been heavy on the e-commerce and SaaS business side of things. e-commerce ones, some with a mix of Amazon or their own direct e-commerce stuff. And then the SaaS ones definitely vary. We love those businesses instead of buyers. So that's the direction we're going to keep going, is largely SaaS and e-commerce type businesses. So,
where do you see the mobile app front heading?
Yeah, I think on that side, there are some people doing some interesting things where they're doing almost like a roll-up strategy, where they're acquiring multiple apps and user bases, and then leveraging those user bases across multiple apps, multiple portfolios. We have some buyer clients in that niche where they'll buy up user bases and they end up licensing out the data to companies, which is a totally different model than most. Yeah, app entrepreneurs or app developers use. That's definitely one direction there. And then I think for some businesses, they can do well with buying some apps or portfolios if it gives them a built-in audience to use for their main business. It can be a good add-on thing that they can leverage. It's definitely tough in general for any developers to compete in that space now. Not impossible, but it's gotten a lot more tough there. So
you think it'd be hard to launch the next Doodle Jump?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely a lot more challenging now than it was just a few years ago. So
what I'm interested in is the motivation comparing the seller to the buyer. So let's say we have someone has a SaaS that's quite popular. Why are they selling it, and why is someone buying it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a lot of our clients tend to fall into the mode of like where they're probably serial entrepreneurs, and they started their business and got really good at doing a couple different things with the business, whether it was marketing or, you know, converting traffic to sales or the product itself. And then lots of times what they do is they get it to a certain level where, you know, they need to start looking at things like building out systems and adding on more team people, whether it's, you know, outsourced people or actual full-time employee type scenario. And then sometimes too, they just need more capital to grow it to the next stage. And lots of our seller clients, once they get to that point, if they started it from scratch and kind of intended it to be like a lifestyle business or, you know, a fun type business for them, they kind of get to that stage and their mindset is usually like, doesn't sound very fun anymore to go do those things. And lots of times too, just also outside their comfort zone in terms of growing it from, yeah, I'd say usually it seems like going from the 1 to 5 million a year in revenue type numbers up to 10, 20 million a year, like definitely takes a different mindset and resources and, you know, leadership within the business to do that. So
yeah.
On the sell side, it's usually what they're looking at.
Oh yeah. Go and continue on that thought.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, so they get to that point where they can almost feel like they're not the right person to take it to the next level. That's largely the mindset and the kind of conclusion that they arrive at.
And do you think there should be any shame in that, or is it okay that, hey, look, you're a person who likes to start things and get it to a certain point, and then there's other people who will then come along and they know what to do with it and to take it to the next stage, and they're happy to just pay money and have it now than to be growing their own?
Yeah, definitely no shame in that at all. I mean, part of it just, you know, whatever your internal motivation is. But yeah, a lot of our seller clients, sometimes they don't exactly want to let it go, but at the same time, they know that it's the right thing to do for them and for the business, where if they plow ahead and try to grow it out themselves, you know, they're going to end up burnt out and frustrated and, you know, who knows, maybe even tank the business and could end up failing versus they can sell it, get some capital and have time off to do what they want or start something brand new with their own capital behind them. That's what a lot of our clients end up doing.
So it could be like the farmer who just loves growing grapes in his vineyard, and then he sells those grapes to a winemaker who will then, you know, buy those ready to go grapes and then squash them up in their vats and store them and then sell them and take them to market as wine. And it could be actually, you know, a distribution sale at the end of that too, where they sell it to a company who puts it in the stores and then sells it to the end user. So some people can handle the whole chain and other people just like to focus on their part of it. I think some of this comes down to knowing where your sweet spot is. Are you a starter? Or are you a finisher? And that will probably determine whether you're a buyer or a seller in some cases.
Yeah, definitely.
So if someone's buying these sort of businesses, what sort of arrangements are you seeing people look at? Do they ever buy a portion of it? I know as a shareholder, we can go along and buy shares in a publicly listed company and we can have a part of a company. But when people are selling their company, do you ever get a scenario where they're saying, look, I just want to sell half my company or 30% of my company or share of it?
Yeah, sometimes it does happen. It seems to happen most where there's scenarios where there's like two or three business partners involved in a business and they, you know, one of them ends up having their lifestyle changes or something happens with their life where they want the business to go in a different direction than their partners do. And so sometimes they'll look to sell off part of it and bring on an investor instead of keeping a business partner relationship. On the buy side too, there's definitely people who they look to buy businesses, but for a lot of them, the ideal scenario is for them to invest in a business and then the current owner keep running it, or they invest in it and bring in someone else to run it and just work with the current owner to make all that happen. Definitely starting to see more of that. We have a deal in closing right now for a small SaaS business where the two founders, they're selling off. They're going to sell more like 90% of it, but they're still going to keep 10% equity and work with a new owner to help them grow it out. And it should work out really well all around.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty common in the property industry too. When a developer builds a whole building and then they sell off most of it and keep the penthouse suite or a retail storefront down the bottom for themselves. So they've got some skin in the game. So if you had a partnership of two and one is decided they want out, can a broker help the remaining partner find an investor to fill that spot?
Yeah, typically. Usually it's something that can help line up. We definitely, in general, you know, kind of look for more scenarios where they're looking to sell off the whole business. But sometimes that just happens dynamically to you, where we'll get a seller client that they go into it thinking they want to sell the whole business. And then during the process of selling, we help them come up with some ideas on improving the business and getting it ready to sell, where they start to fall back in love with it a little bit. And then, but they still might need some capital to grow it to the next level. And they know they can't just self-fund everything. So those are the scenarios where lots of times they'll bring out an investor who usually can add the financial capital and usually some other value they bring to the table as well.
Do all businesses need this capital injection? There must be occasionally businesses that are self-funded with a good profit margin and are privately held and just continue to snowball.
Yeah, definitely. There's some. One trend we're seeing lately, though, is like with e-commerce businesses where people are selling on Amazon or other platforms where, you know, some of them may go from like zero revenue to within a year or two. We have one client within 2 years they started and now they're doing $6 million a year in sales, you know, over $1 million a year in profit. Now, for them to keep growing beyond that, they definitely need to start doing things like doing some larger inventory purchases, and where they have to better manage their cash flow, where they might need capital, but they might need some things like lines of credit and at least start doing some more financial management than they did when they first ran it as a lifestyle business. Yeah.
Now, what sort of profit margin spread would you see for a typical business that is looking to sell? And also, I mean, should be clear here, this is when you take into account the owners, you know, paying for their groceries and fuel bills and stuff. Like, those records should be kept out of the business and paid as a wage or something to keep it separate, right, to allow for a commercial wage for the owner instead.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those that type of thing. That's one thing where as these internet businesses get more sophisticated and keep going in that direction, that's one thing that owners, the startup entrepreneurs are going to have to, I think, do a better job of, where they it's not exciting to keep clean financials, but the payoff down the road, I mean, can be the difference for like...
It is so easy now. If you just run Xero or QuickBooks and you have someone in your team allocating costs, it's just so simple to, like, even just to pay yourself a wage for non-business deductible expenses and just separate it out. You know, it's pretty straightforward. But I do see a lot of small business owners drawing all the money out of the business just to fund living expenses and non-business expenses. It's going to be impossible for them to sell that business.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It looks really messy for especially smart buyers. Looking from the outside in, they look at it and it just raises questions and red flags, and they see it. They devalue it for sure because they see that it's not been run as a real separate business entity. And it can doing the clean financials too can pay off big time nowadays for sellers, because there's more buyers now that can actually get financing for these type of businesses, whether it's a regular bank financing, or here in the US we have the Small Business Administration loans, lines of credit. There's alternate funding sources showing up now, like places like lightercapital.com and sasscapital.com, that with those ones, they'll fund the businesses, but the businesses do need clean financials and tax returns and things like that, where if everything matches up, then it makes it nice and clean and easy and opens up a lot of doors for sellers to be able to get sell for maximum value versus taking a price and deal structure that might be way, way less.
Right, so clean financials and having good up-to-date tax returns is going to make it easier for the seller, and it's much easier for a buyer to see what they're actually getting.
Yeah, and financially, I mean, it can be the difference between like maybe doing a deal where it's, something like whatever, 1.5, 2 times the yearly free cash flow to the owner, to something where it's more 4 to 5 times. Like that's
So let's talk about the profit spread. I didn't get a number out of you. I probably should.
yeah, like profit margin wise, we see that all across the board. But I think for like the SaaS businesses, I think that's one of the appeal for a lot of them, is they can be really high profit margin. Like I think we have one right now that's about, I think it's close to like 80% margins. The e-commerce ones, they do seem to get to a certain level, at least maybe a certain niche markets that don't have as big a margins, but some of those seem like they range in like the 20 to 30%, at least somewhere in that range. So.
Right. Well, 80% sounds extremely high, even for
Yeah.
companies like Facebook, which are, I guess, effectively an app. They'd be less than half of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, what about multiples? The multiples going to be different depending on whether the business is one-time products or recurring, and whether they're in certain niches.
Yeah, definitely. Like the ones like you said, the big thing is recurring revenue. I mean, any business that has recurring revenue, likely there's going to be a buyer for it out there somewhere, and they're going to pay, way more than they would without that. That's the thing. It's one of the reasons people like the buyers like the software as a service model. It's because it's something that typically it's proven. Lots of times they're not all B2B type models. Sometimes it is B2C for SaaS stuff, but in general, the ones we see, they're really heavy, business to business type stuff, where B2B SaaS recurring revenue, those are the ones we see that get the highest multiples, where we got one deal done, I think, for it was close to like 7 to 8 times the yearly, I mean, call it profit, EBITDA, whatever number you consider that to be. So versus e-commerce ones, those ones so far have tended to sell for somewhere between these days like 2 to 3.5 times the yearly EBITDA type of number. Some are trending up a little bit bigger. I think once they get up to where they're doing over $1 million a year in profit, then opens up the door to some bigger buyers that they look for that number. It's a definite target for them, the $1 million a year in profit. I think because they see it as like a more defensible business where that cash flow stream isn't going to go away at that point, as long as they meet.
And what about if it's a personal services business, or it's more of a informational business? Does the multiple start to come down a bit?
Yeah, definitely the service ones. We've experimented around with that a little bit. We don't do a lot of those these days, but the couple we have sold definitely fall more in like the 1 to 2 times yearly type of number.
Well, that's still, even a personal service business, the owner selling that could have a year or two off and start something else, still get paid as if they were working, right?
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
that's all very interesting. I'm just wondering, in terms of us buying a business, what sort of statistics have you seen for once the sale's taken place between the seller and the buyer in terms of success rate? Do the transactions turn out to be good or bad in hindsight for the buyers?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've never had any go bad. We look to help structure deals where it's yeah, it's going to make sense for the seller to sell, and then also for the buyer, where they're going to be able to get an ROI on it, as long as they don't, you know, totally just horrendously mismanage it for some reason. The only times we've had anything go bad is we had one website hosting deal we did years ago where the new owner came in and they decided to change it from like monthly billing to yearly billing, and also like whacked all the affiliate commissions for their whole affiliate program, which was a key marketing channel. That one, it started to go down pretty quickly after that, as you can imagine, but the previous owner was able to step back in and help them get it back up and going. We did have one other one where the buyer, like they bought it, it was a partly SaaS and part information product business. They wanted the SaaS and they bought the whole business with both included. I don't think they really knew what they were going to do with the information product business. And they ended up, I think, over a period of time, they just handed that back to the previous owner because they didn't really have a use for it. I think on the buy side, definitely it's important they have a clear plan of what they're going to do with the business when they do take it over. Most sophisticated buyers do, you know, whether they're going to be leveraging the customer base or the products, they typically have a clear plan on that. The one thing I've seen with more individual type buyers that are buying some of these e-commerce businesses that I would encourage them to look for is the scenario where the current owner is willing to work with them over some period of time to help roll out new products, or where the current owner has a solid product plan in place of, you know, if they were going to keep the business, what products they would roll out over the, you know, period of the next year. That way it gives the new owner a good plan of attack, and they should be able to keep the revenue going no problem with that kind of thing in place. And the current owner usually is going to understand that niche market a lot better than the new owner. So
yeah, that's nice. I've seen this work well where someone sells the business and then they go on a percentage of revenue coaching retainer to continue to grow it from the point of sale upwards, so that it's positively benefiting them if it increases and there's no payout if it decreases.
Yeah, definitely.
What sort of things have you seen as new trends for buyers in the market that you mentioned before already, that there's new people coming to the market that you haven't seen before, like actual investors, and now you can even get loans for it. That must, you know, really open up the potential competition for people trying to buy businesses. What sort of weird or strange things have you seen them asking for or doing that they might have brought from outside the traditional industry that is changing the marketplace?
Yeah, there's definitely a few things. One, only odd request is seemingly we had a buyer where the business has like 9 years of 9 years of history, and they wanted to see every single year of the past 9 years of financials, even though, yeah, 9 years ago doesn't really mean much nowadays in the internet world.
Yeah.
But I think the buyers in general, they're also starting to look at things like metrics within the business that before they didn't really even care about. So like it helps if sellers know their niche market and any or industry typical benchmarks, like profit margin, for example. You know, if most people are getting a 10% profit margin or 20%, you can set it up where your business is doing 40%. It makes your business way more attractive and sounds simple, but there can be metrics like that where just they set it apart for the business buyers. One of the things we've seen is we've definitely seen some buyers now, they're looking for a whole bunch of different things around what I would call defensibility, whether it's they're looking for deals that, yeah, the business may have some products that are either they already have patents or stuff within the business that could be patentable. They're looking for trademarks. They want to make sure like the business brand name is trademarked, and ideally key products are trademarked wherever possible, just to keep other people from using those names and stuff. And they're definitely looking for more things like more sophisticated agreements in terms of like product licensing and supplier agreements, things along those lines. That and then also too, like any sales channel type exclusive agreements, like special terms that the current owner can pass on to the new owner. Those are some of the big things we've seen lately.
Have you ever seen someone buy a business just to shut it down as a defensive move?
We saw that with apps a couple times a few years back. Haven't seen it on the internet business side yet, although we do have a couple listings right now where like the key competitors are definitely, they're looking at the acquisition. I think that's one of the reasons that they are doing it. They haven't come out and said that, but
Well, it's really common for large companies like Google and Facebook to acquire business units that they think could compete with them, and they quite often they'll leave it stand as its own thing, but then occasionally they will just roll it in to the whole machine. You mentioned that you'd be looking for supplier agreements. What other documents would we need to be looking for if we're going to buy a business? What must we validate?
Yeah, it's a great point. Of course, you know, financials, and that's the key thing. And then, yeah, supplier agreements, especially nowadays with people, you know, especially like e-commerce businesses where they're sourcing things from China, just a different world than what they've never owned a business and done product sourcing stuff, then they definitely want a good solid supplier agreements for that type of thing. Maybe even we've had some seller clients where they've gone to China and established networks and connections there, and have offered to basically take the new owner over there and make sure those connections get made in person. A little bit more old school. You don't think of that when you're thinking about an internet business. When you're doing bigger deals, if that's how business is done lots of times. So
that's exactly what I offered with the sale of my service business. It was a face-to-face introduction with the team in a different country. I talk about an asset register, which is kind of like an online version of the book, but it's a central register with links to all of the documents and IP that an online business needs, like the domain name, the standard operating procedures, the team members, the database, all those things like are all linked from one document. Have you ever seen a sale go through where there was something missing, or maybe you've picked up a client who tried to sell it before and it fell over because it had something missing that is like a real rookie error that you would advise people to be cautious about?
We haven't seen that exactly, but what you mentioned, I mean, that's awesome to have in place for sure. That's something I think buyers are looking for nowadays. People that are used to, you know, running offline businesses where they just like all that stuff is expected to be in place, where you've got the systems, processes, and procedures, and it's written down somewhere. It's not just in the owner's head or in the head of a VA, like that's where it's actually written down somewhere. So if the worst case scenario happened and the owner was just, you know, went away, that someone else could step in and actually at least run the business to some degree.
Well, we treat it like an in case of emergency file. It's like someone should be able to grab that. It's like you're in a plane and the pilot's passed out. You should be able to follow this asset register and find every vital document for the business. So it's designed to improve the works without me factor, which obviously is a constant battle for small-time business owners as they grow their business, is to let go of things and turn that thing from a job into something saleable.
Yeah, definitely. One thing along those lines just came to mind in terms of like a rookie error is once in a while we'll have a client. It tends to be like a smaller internet business scenario where, you know, they may have they may be running like three different businesses and online sites or businesses where, and they have things all commingled. So like their CRM or email lists or hosting where just it's all mixed up together. So then they try and go and sell one of their websites, and then they have to do a lot of work to unravel things to the point where they can actually hand it off to a new owner. So things like that, it's worth a little bit of effort up front to segregate that stuff out, thinking ahead where if you needed to hand it off to a new owner, you can just hand them, like you said, and here's the list of everything.
Yeah. Well, certainly some things are easier. Like it's a great point you mentioned. Before I sold my businesses, I had to separate them out onto their own websites, make sure that all of the database was tagged and segmented, which already was, luckily. It's easy to export a database. But by far the hardest thing is recurring billing with things like PayPal or credit card. Ideally, you'd set up a separate cart for each business unit if you know it's going to be a decent-sized business unit, and keep it on its own billing system. Things like Stripe, for example, apparently it's easier to just hand over a Stripe account to a new owner. So you could set up a new Stripe for each business division, which is what my clients are doing now. in the case that they want to sell the business, it's easier to hand that off than it is to move a PayPal account. And then you sort of get into the more complex stuff, like, are you selling the assets of a business or are you transferring the entity? And from what I can tell, a lot of these businesses, they'd rather buy assets and move the assets across from one entity to another than to take on the potential risk of getting involved with some foreign entity.
Yeah. Yeah. Typically that's exactly, it's like almost always what they look to do. Once in a while, there'll be some scenario where it makes sense to do an entity deal, but yeah, usually they like to avoid any potential risks there for sure.
Yeah. Imagine if you bring in an investor in to replace a director or a shareholder and owner of a business, then they're probably going to be more direct. But what are some of the other sophisticated things you're seeing with buyers? Like deals that might be more creative or that are options. I know I've talked in previous episodes about basic ones like vendor finance and earnouts and taking a passive role, even taking revenue share deals. There must be ways that people are structuring this when they don't have the cash.
Yeah, there's creative ways, and I think lots of times it comes down to how what the seller is looking to do. And yeah, we get some buyers where they're able to do some deals where, like, we just did one recently where it's part cash and then part seller financing and like you said, or vendor financing, and it can work out well for the seller depending on their financial scenario, where they're able to spread that money out over time versus taking it all in one year as a bigger tax hit. And it also too, on the buyer side, I mean, they think a lot of it in the back of the buyer's mindset. There's the financial part, and they're also looking at it as like, how do I minimize my risk and make sure I get an ROI on this deal? So those are where some things can work well. Like we just did an e-commerce deal where it was part cash, and then a good chunk of the deal was back in money for profit sharing, where the owners had some specialized knowledge in this niche market that conceivably they're not going to be able to transfer it all in like a 30, 60 day training period. It's going to take some time. And so the new owner wanted them to work with them and be able to help roll out some products and utilize their insider knowledge. So they're doing some profit sharing stuff that almost ends up being partial, like part equity. But I think the buyers these days can get some more creative hybrid deals done if they know what their desired end game is. And then just a matter of finding the right business and the right seller that matches up with that.
Perfect. Yeah, I think it pays to be a bit creative if it allows you to do a deal that can't be done any other way. I mean, ideally, I'm sure a lot of sellers just would love you to pay all the cash up front and be out of the business with zero risk. But I don't know if it's that competitive that they can always demand that.
No.
But if you're looking at a collaboration, it can work really well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the people that are some of the more sophisticated buyers buying these internet businesses now, they're used to doing deals, in the offline world that are not 100% cash. I mean, just, it happens sometimes, sometimes you hear about those type of deals that are the bigger deals, or some company gets acquired for some crazy valuation and it's all cash or whatever. But that doesn't happen on a day-to-day basis. Typically it's more combination of cash and seller financing and earn out or equity. The more typical real world business scenario that they're definitely bringing that to the internet business acquisition type of stuff.
Who prepares and pays for the legal agreements?
Yeah, it's a great question. For our deals, the smaller ones at least, we have a base contract our attorney created that we normally start from just to help save some time and legal fees. But at that stage, buyers almost always have an attorney involved. And then our seller clients, we even encourage them to have an attorney involved at that point, just to at least do contract review stuff and make sure they're protected for their current business and what they want to do next. And also, what they have going on in their overall, personal life outside of the business stuff, which as brokers, we don't necessarily have visibility into everything. But so at the contract review stage, definitely encourage both sides to have an attorney involved at that point.
Right. So would the more advanced buyers be sometimes generating the purchase offer, or is it usually the seller providing the contract of sale?
Yeah, the sophisticated ones, it's usually the buyer that's driving that. It's coming to the table with their contracts. So on the flip side, sellers definitely want to have an attorney.
Is it a case that whoever prepares the contracts, it's usually, you know, slightly biased towards them?
You know, yeah. I mean, some to a like almost laughable degree, which I don't like to see. Where just like
I've done a whole podcast series on this with a lawyer, and it is funny. My advice or my opinion is simply you get it ratified. If you're going to do a big transaction, involve a legal person who's specialized in that, and not because you love spending the money, but because their job is to protect you from making a terrible mistake.
Yeah, I just have a seller client right now where they've been talking the other day, and he's like, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes in business. He's like, but the biggest mistake I ever made was signing a bad contract years ago.
Yep, I've seen people get bankrupted from signing a contract that just, you know, backdrafts them into someone else's affairs, you know, unknowingly. It's definitely one to watch for. So, gosh, we've covered quite a range of things from the point of view of a buyer and also a seller, and especially given some good ideas on things to look for margins and deal structure and the documents that we need to be mindful of and some of the changes in the industry. Eric, what should I be asking you as we close out here? What's another important topic that I've maybe overlooked so far?
I mean, you know, one thing that I still see sellers make the mistake of, and buyers are asking for this more and more, is where they will, you know, it's, I guess, probably human nature when you're first starting up a business, where you get good at, you know, relying upon like one traffic source or one source of sales, where buyers now are looking at it where they ideally want to see like some customer acquisition strategy where there's some proven repeatable system for acquiring new leads and customers with, you know, multiple traffic sources to accomplish that, versus, I say, some people just rely on one source of traffic, like Amazon, for example, which works great for cash flow, but buyers will value that a lot less than they would, say, an e-commerce business with multiple sources of traffic for leads and customers. I think that's something.
That is a hot tip. I'm so passionate about that. I even created an entire course on it called Own the Race Course, because single source dependency sinks a lot of businesses, and that's everything from payment processes through to support to product lines, etc. That's such a great point, Eric. Well, I think we've delivered quite a few ideas here. I'm going to say thank you for coming along to the podcast and talking about these issues. As a seller or a buyer of a business, I'm sure something's going to pop out from this episode. Eric, thanks for coming along.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was great. I really appreciate it.
So I've been speaking with Eric Owens from appbusinessbrokers.com. If you're looking to buy or sell a business, I'd suggest you check out his website, get in touch. He's extremely knowledgeable in this topic. If you have a substantial business and you want to make it better, then I could certainly help you with my coaching at superfastbusiness.com. Or silvercircle.com if you have a bigger business and you want to protect yourself from some of these mistakes, or if you want to get it ready to sell, then I know that I could help you as well. All right. Well, that's another episode of superfastbusiness.com. Thank you for joining us.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.